Highs 40 to 46. Northwest wind around 5 miles per hour. Overnight lows in the mid-20s.
Hello, I'm Helen Mann.
And I'm Chris Howden, coming up on As It Happens.
For Russia with Love, one assumes. For decades, the late FBI agent Robert Hansen delivered top secret information to Russia before he was finally caught and sent to prison, where he died yesterday. The undercover agent who trapped him tells us how he did it.
And bovine intervention. Lester is not a sheep. Not literally and not figuratively. He's a bull, and when he decided to go his own way yet again by charging off down a Michigan highway on the weekend, our guest was in hot pursuit. The cowcatcher explains how he caught the cow.
Those stories and more coming up on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're listening to As It Happens here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Mental Health Crisis Response Team of Itasca County. This crisis intervention service is a program of First Call for Help 211 and provides free crisis assessments, stabilization services, referrals, and resourcing to residents of any age who are in crisis. Available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 211. The AARP Foundation Tax Aid Program is providing free income tax preparation for people over the age of 50 or those with modest income at the Bemidji Senior Center now through April 14th. They're available for walk-in appointments on a first-come, first-served basis, Mondays, Thursdays, and Fridays from 9 to 1. Warm up your winter by giving back. Donate your car, RV, or boat to KAXE to support independent community radio. Call 855-277-2346 or email Heather at KAXE.org. Now to play a song for you, this is Wild Nothing with Wheel of Misfortune.
World gone mad. The star
And that is Wild Nothing with the song Wheel of Misfortune.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Numbers game. Canada's next election campaign begins, and the man who runs the CBC poll tracker breaks down the numbers for us and tells us what the leaders' first campaign stops tell us about how they are breaking down the numbers.
Closing the books. Two libraries in Saskatoon suspend their services after a surge of overdoses. A union rep tells us staff just aren't equipped to handle the crisis.
Palate Cleanser, a Toronto food blogger, taps into the current tension with the U.S. by highlighting Canadian cuisine. And his picks often come with a side of controversy.
Sound effects. Researchers find that common urban spiders are devising their own solution to noise pollution, but it comes with strings attached.
Don't move a muscle car. A Winnipegger goes to Texas to buy the 1968 Dodge Charger he has dreamed of for years. But when he tries to get it over the border, things come to a screeching halt.
And what has eight arms, several fins, and truly terrifying teeth?
An octopus riding on a shark's head.
That's ridiculous. Actually, yes. We'll talk to a marine ecologist who took video of the weird aquatic hitchhiking pair that she calls Sharktopus. As it happens, the Monday edition, radio that's a total head trip. It's been a busy 24 hours for the leaders of Canada's major political parties, and their itineraries say a lot about where they'll be focusing their attention over the course of this five-week election campaign.
Oh, God. Thank God I'm in St. John's. There is no better place to start the most consequential election in our history than right here, right now.
Who's ready to axe some taxes? Yeah. Who's ready to build some homes? Yeah. Who's ready to bring home the Canadian promise? Yeah.
This is very incredible land in the middle, you know, in the community of Montreal. This should be used to build homes. 4 years later, the Liberals did nothing. Nothing has been done here.
Liberal Party leader Mark Carney, Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre, and NDP leader Jagmeet Singh campaigning in St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador, North York, Ontario, and Montreal, Quebec, respectively. All calculated choices, and the calculations are based, in large part, on the math of folks like Eric Grenier. Mr. Grenier runs theRIT.ca and the CBC's poll tracker. We reached him in Ottawa.
Eric, we are reaching you at the start of a campaign that is certainly more competitive at this stage than anyone, and you included, were predicting just a few months ago. How much have things changed in the lead up to this race?
Things have really changed dramatically. It's not very often that you have a party gaining 15 to 20 points in the run-up to an election campaign. At the beginning of the year, when Justin Trudeau resigned, the Liberals were 25 points behind the Conservatives. They're at risk of being perhaps overtaken by the NDP for second spot. And instead, what we've seen is that over the last 2 months, there's been a huge gain in support for the Liberals, a drop for the Conservatives, a drop for the NDP, drop for the Bloc Québécois as well. And instead of an inevitable Conservative majority victory, we're now looking at a toss-up that is surprisingly Mark Carney's campaign to lose.
Do you recall seeing a swing like this before? Is there a campaign that this evokes in your mind?
The nearest precedence we could probably look at would be the 1984 or 1993 elections, when there was an unpopular prime minister in place who resigned. It was Pierre Trudeau in 84, it was Brian Mulroney in 1993. A new leader comes along, John Turner, Kim Campbell. They get a boost in the polls. And then, of course, the campaigns go very badly for both of those leaders, and they end up suffering catastrophic defeats. So there are those examples, but that's 30 or 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the context is pretty different. There wasn't that volatile, unpredictable force that is Donald Trump back in those campaigns.
Where all of the main party leaders chose to start their campaigns is certainly significant. None of this is an accident. There's strategy and calculations at play. So I want to go through for our listeners with you each of those decisions. And we'll start with Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre. He had events yesterday in Manotick, Ontario, as well as North York. And then there was an announcement in Brampton, Ontario today. So what does it tell you that Pierre Poilievre is beginning with a focus decidedly on Ontario?
Yeah, well, Manotick, you know, he's doing his first visit to his riding. It might be the only one he'll do during the campaign. But heading to the GTA, that is really where the Conservatives need to be spending most of their time. The Liberals have almost swept the GTA in each of the last three elections. So the Conservatives need to pierce that Liberal fortress that has become the GTA. Before the poll swung, it looked like the GTA was going to go pretty blue, but now it does look like it is going to be a battleground place for both the Liberals and the Conservatives. So not a surprise for Pierre Poilievre to head there. I'd be surprised if he didn't head there on the first day of the campaign.
The leader of the Liberal Party, Mark Carney, was in St. John's yesterday, and then this morning in Gander, Newfoundland and Labrador. Your poll tracker suggests, though, the Liberals are already leading, and leading by quite a bit in Atlantic Canada. Why do you think Mark Carney started there?
That one, it might be a little bit more puzzling. I do think it helped him make the message today in his visit to Gander about relations with the United States. Of course, Gander being the place where planes were diverted on 9/11. The riding he did visit today, Central Newfoundland, is a Conservative riding, so they might have been playing a little bit of offense. But maybe we'll get a better idea of what Mark Carney's plans are. At first, I wouldn't have thought St. John's would have been where he'd head on the first day, but they do have to shore up those ridings in Atlantic Canada that have been, you know, one of the pillars of the last few Liberal governments.
Jagmeet Singh and the NDP were in Ottawa and Montreal. They're set to arrive in Toronto this evening. Their seat projections in both provinces and across the country actually don't paint the best of pictures for the NDP. Is there any sense that they could turn that around?
Well, they're going to have to, because the New Democrats are in a lot of trouble. They've dropped a lot in the polls. They're right now at around 11% in our poll tracker. So for Jagmeet Singh, where he goes is going to be a bit of a challenge, because out of the three main leaders, Jagmeet Singh might at this stage be the least popular one. I think that with the NDP where they are in the polls right now, their incumbent MPs have to rely on their own name, their own profile to get themselves elected. A visit from the leader may or may not be that helpful in the current context.
You said elsewhere that polls are, quote, not necessarily supposed to tell you how to vote or who is going to win, unquote. People may be surprised to hear you say that. Tell them, what are polls supposed to do?
Well, polls, I think, are about understanding what's happening in a race, why parties might be promising what they're promising, who they're going after, who they're attacking. And yes, it does actually show as well who are the front runners, who are the real parties vying for government. So if people are making their choices based on who they want to see in power, you know, then maybe polls can serve a purpose that way. But it really is just telling us how the campaign is unfolding. And I think it is one of the more objective sources of information we have. So people should not base too much on the polls. They should not be the majority of the information people are consuming. Obviously, they need to know what the leaders are promising, who the local candidates are. The polls are fun to watch, and maybe that can get people a bit more engaged in politics, but it's not the most important thing in any campaign.
Do you think this election might get more people interested and watching and participating, because you've already described the kind of swings we've seen so far? It's a pivotal election wherever you sit. What are you excited for?
Yeah, I do think this is going to be a campaign that people are really going to be tuned into. I think people are very politically engaged just because of what's been happening in the United States over the last little while. And we've actually seen some polling that suggests people are more interested in this campaign than they were the last one, which was, in retrospect, a bit of a snoozer. This one does look like it's going to be very hotly contested. And when an election is competitive, I think it just raises the stakes for everybody. So I'm excited to see how this is going to unfold, because I was ready for a campaign that was not going to have many surprises. But I guess the biggest surprise is that this campaign is going to be pretty unpredictable.
A pleasure speaking with you, Eric. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Eric Grenier runs the RIT.ca and the CBC's poll tracker. We reached him in Ottawa. Thank you. Rochelle Constantine has seen it all. Fish, other fish, weird fish, normal fish doing weird stuff. I mean, when I say she's seen it all, I mean she's seen it all in the water. She's a marine ecologist in Auckland, New Zealand. But one particular thing she's seen in the water haunts her to this day. On a field trip, she and her team came across a shark, normal. But when they took a closer look, they realized the shark had something else on its head, something of a rusty orange color. We reached Rochelle Constantine today in Auckland.
Rochelle, when you first saw this happening, you see this shark go by, there's an orange blob on its head. What did you think it was?
At first, it was very clear. It was a very large shark. It had a very big dorsal fin, so that always piques our curiosity. We're quite lucky. We have quite a few sharks here, but yeah. This one was quite different. It had a really large, orangey brown shape on its head, and sort of at first we're like, oh, is it entangled in a buoy, some sort of fishing gear or something like that, or maybe it had had an injury, because injuries often have unusual colors under the water. So that made us kind of like, well, let's go and check out what this is.
And as you did check out what it was, what finally tipped you off that it wasn't a buoy or something else?
Yeah, so we didn't want to, approach the shark, too sort of suddenly. Mm-hmm. And so we just sort of kept meandering along off to the side of it. And so I got Wednesday, one of our technicians, to put the drone up. And she looked over it and the top of it and couldn't work out what it was. And was dropping the drone down. And at the same time, we sort of moved, gently closer to the shark, and it just kept swimming gently along. And we could see these tentacles being pulled in. And, someone yelled out, "It's an octopus." And it was at the same time. That was very clear from the drone as well. So, it was just not even remotely what we expected. Was to see this very large octopus. The shark is about 3 meters long. And so that's a pretty big octopus perched on top of its head.
And so just hitching a ride, you think? They're buddies?
We don't know what.
I mean, I'm writing so much fan fiction in my head.
I think as long as the octopus stays away from the Marco shark's mouth, they're probably definitely buddies. But the thing that was fascinating for us is how the shark was very, calmly just moving through the waters. They often do. They're often, pretty relaxed most of their time, despite what media would have you think. And the octopus, it was definitely working to keep itself very contained on top. So you could see, a tentacle would sort of stray out every now and then, or it would reach it out and then pull it back in quite quickly. And when we put the GoPro over the side as well, and the shark sort of came quite close to us at one point, that was when we were able to sort of see, how big the octopus, how much space on the top it took up. How they actually found each other is, I think, the greatest mystery.
Because they live in different parts of the ocean.
Completely different places. Like they have very different worlds. The octopus, which is a New Zealand octopus or a Māori octopus, it's the largest octopus in the Southern Hemisphere. And they live on the seabed. They, they are very much live in rocky areas or move along the sand. So they're quite happy. That's their place, and everything that they need is down there. Whereas Marco sharks are sort of mid-water, open water, pelagic. They can dive to quite deep, but they're never at the seabed, as far as we know. But who knows how these two came in contact with each other, because they live in very different parts of the ocean.
The song "Part of Your World" from The Little Mermaid has now been playing for the last 2 minutes of our conversation. I just wanted to let you know. I mean, the shark must have been aware that there was something on top of it, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Sharks have incredibly sensitive sort of lateral line systems. So they've got very, very, very acute sensory systems. And I've no doubt that it knew there was something plonked on top of its head. But they do often, sharks will often have remoras or similar kind of, sucker type fish attached to them at various points in different parts of the world. So it's not completely unusual for them to have something attached to them. Some people sort of asked, why wasn't the shark freaking out because it had a giant octopus
trying to shake
on its head?
Yeah, shake it away.
Yeah, exactly. But it wasn't, it just clearly wasn't too bothered. But it would have known it was there.
You, I know, spoke with other researchers about this this incredible thing that you all saw. Could they give you any explanation?
No.
And are you okay with that? I mean, I wonder
yeah.
the mystery of it all, the fun of it all.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, one of the of course, you know, this is a science curiosity. It's you know, I'm talking to you in Canada, sitting here in Auckland in New Zealand about this neat thing. And the reason why we, you know, chose to put this out into the world is kind of two things. One is, you know, I think we need something that's light and novel and something people, including us as scientists, would never have thought could happen. And the other thing is for people to actually stop and just really think about the ocean and how many amazing things there are in the ocean. You know, we often hear, you know, sharks are bad or, you know, sharks attacking people. There's a lot of that kind of narrative around sharks pretty much globally. And similarly with octopus, you know, there's something we eat or there's something that sometimes you might see in a rock pool or if you're lucky, if you're a diver, see them on the seabed. But really, you know, the lives of these animals is so much more than how we perceive them and how they impact us. And I think that's true of everything in the ocean. I really love that all over the world in all these languages, people are talking about, well, what is that? Why would they find each other? You know, what is going on?
You've also, you and the team have come up with a pretty great name for what you saw.
Yeah, seemed appropriate. It got named almost instantly on the water. The Sharktopus.
Should trademark that fast. So there's already some references to that in comic books, perhaps, or films.
Yeah, I think there is. I saw it. We Googled it just the other day. Someone was asking about it, and I was like, "Oh, there it is! It's in a bunch of different places." The imagination's well, it's come to life.
Rochelle, a real pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Rochelle Constantine is a marine ecologist and a professor at the University of Auckland. We reached her in Auckland, New Zealand. True patriot love is sweeping Canada. People are buying Canadian, supporting Canadian businesses, and defending Canadian sovereignty. We've never been hungrier for Canadian content. And one Torontonian is doing his part to sate that hunger, literally. 2 weeks ago, Ashim Agarwal started highlighting iconic Canadian food.
I'm eating iconic Canadian foods for 20 days straight, and day one, I had to start with our national dish, poutine. Or should I say poutine? Day two is the Montreal bagel. Day three is ketchup chips and all dress chips.
Ashim Agarwal, who posts on Instagram under the handle Seed Eat Repeat, we reached Mr. Agarwal in Toronto.
Ashim, I'm glad you said poutine as well as poutine.
Right?
I mean, you're heading off the criticism, trying to head off the criticism at that point. But thinking of our listeners in Quebec or those who have Quebec in their hearts, they're never going to believe that you can get authentic poutine in Toronto.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's definitely an uphill battle to convince them. But I promise you, the spot that I went to, it's a very proud Quebecois man named Mark. He's very particular about his sourcing of cheese curds. I think it's, you know, the best we can do here in Toronto. I'm not going to make any claims as to how it compares to spots in Quebec, but I'm glad we have it. I'm glad we have them in the city.
Yeah, and you're certainly not alone. You started this series on March 5th. The timing is not an accident. Why did you want to take this on?
Yeah, honestly, it was a bit of a spur of the moment decision. I think we've all being more reactive than proactive, given that there's 10, 20 news items every day. And I think every day people are evaluating what's happening with our country more broadly and how it's going to affect their lives. My work has always been about highlighting small businesses, local spots. And my general focus tends to be highlighting those that are underrepresented, essentially what I don't see in other food media. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought this could be a fun approach of doing the same, especially at a time where I know small businesses and all of us really are going to feel the pinch in some sort of way. So I was like, at least I can highlight 20 small businesses and hopefully inspire people to go look within their community.
And what kind of reaction have you been getting online so far?
Overall, a really great response. People have been really engaged with it. And I think people have a lot of pride and opinions. And I think that's a beautiful thing. Like, people have been engaged in sharing their stories and having these nuanced discussions. So I kind of want the videos to be a little bit more of like a conversation starter, and hopefully kind of underlying is that pride. But then I love when people have discussions and debates, and I think that's what it should be. You know, it should be a discussion.
Yeah. Well, opinions and pride, debate and discussion certainly come into play when we go through some of your picks. And at the top of that list, Donner, certainly all of that applies to me. Yes. Because, and we've talked about it on the show in different iterations before, and I always feel I have to say Donner means to turn. Turkey certainly doesn't own Donner, but it means the turning of the spit.
Yes.
And there's lots of different iterations of it, different sauces. We've talked about it, you know, on the show, as I said. But this is you covering one establishment. We're gonna listen to that now.
This might be the most controversial Canadian food, and it all comes down to whether you like sweet meat.
First of all, why is it sweet? Donut is not sweet. Any donut I've had. But I do recognize that Halifax Donut and the sauce that comes with it is unique to Halifax. Yeah. And to Canada. So tell our listeners who haven't had a chance to try it what it's all about.
Yeah, so the Halifax Donair, I think like a lot of Canadian foods that I've ended up featuring in this, are really a matter of immigrant communities having a certain frame of reference or a certain dish that they're proud about, and then adapting to both local palates as well as the ingredients available. So this is the story of a Greek man who took the gyro, which itself, you know, originates in Turkey, and he took the gyro and he switched, for example, from lamb to beef because locally lamb was not a particularly popular meat. And then to cater to the local palate, he developed this sweeter doner sauce, which is evaporated or condensed milk based. And a lot of it.
It's popular. It's popular for sure. Pizza also on your list. Two of your 20 days are dedicated to pizza. Day six was Hawaiian, which we've certainly has a place in the history of As It Happens. Day 15 was Windsor pizza. How did you narrow down this list, first of all, and then decide that two should be dedicated to pizza?
I must say I'm a little bit biased. Pizza is my personal favorite food, has been my entire life. So any chance I can take to eat pizza, I go for it. Hawaiian pizza, actually another Greek man invented this. Yes. In Chatham, Ontario. So that's a great story.
His picture hangs in our office.
I love it. Yeah, I'm a huge pineapple on pizza guy, so I am particularly proud of that one. And then Windsor style pizza, honestly, it's totally unique. Has like a cornmeal crust, but I think what makes it really different is they shred the pepperoni instead of using cupped pepperoni. Ooh. The idea being that you get pepperoni in every bite versus when you eat the cups, you might get
awful.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I still don't know how I feel about it or what I prefer. And then they use a very specific cheese and canned mushrooms, which I am converted to. I think I like canned mushrooms more on pizza.
That's a hard sell, dude. That's a hard sell. But
fair, but you got to try it. You got to try it.
Yeah, I would not turn it down. I would not turn down a slice by any means. You talked about the debate and the discussion and being prepared for the response. So far, we've been able to see what looks to be your most controversial selection was on day 9. You're chuckling. You tried a food from Newfoundland and Labrador for the first time, and people commenting, you know, Matty Matheson, a lot of people love Matty Matheson. They know him from The Bear as well as his restaurants. But they're pushing back some of the responses, saying the one you went to is not authentic.
Yeah. And I totally respect it. That episode kind of exemplifies the challenge of the series, in that there isn't necessarily a whole lot of room for me to fly to Newfoundland and go to somebody's grandmother's house, as I've been suggested to do, and have a traditional Jigs dinner. That episode was really just, hey, I've never had Jigs dinner. This is the first restaurant in Toronto I've ever seen it on a menu. a curiosity, and also, you know, it'd be great to highlight the food of Newfoundland and Labrador in some way. My main takeaway from that is I got to go to Newfoundland someday.
Yeah, plus one for me, Asham. I'm so glad we could speak. Thank you for this. It was fun.
Thank you.
Asham Agarwal is Seed Eat Repeat on Instagram. We reached him in Toronto. Like most city dwellers, I am impressively resilient when it comes to noise pollution. It's not to brag, Neil, laughing, but I can completely block it out. I can barely hear you laughing. It's like I can not even hear noise pollution at all anymore. For me, living in an urban metropolis that's thrumming with engine noise and angry hollering is as peaceful as a bucolic countryside. It's as serene as birdsong. No noise can pierce my psychoacoustic shield. I am utterly for the love of Pete, will you make that unholy noise stop? I'm sorry about my serenity there. They just installed a pickleball court down the hall from the studio. I haven't quite adjusted to the new neighbors yet. Anyway, researchers have found that, unlike me, funnel web spiders are bothered by the near-constant urban noise that surrounds them. Although from their perspective, it's not so much noise since they have no ears, it's bad vibrations, which is a problem because they rely on their hypersensitivity to vibrations for everything from catching food to finding a mate. Now, new research in the journal Current Biology investigated what the spiders are doing about that by capturing them and, as I understand it, basically blaring white noise at them, or pickleball sounds. And the result was that the spiders got to work soundproofing their webs, building them in such a way that they were less sensitive to vibrations. Now, the downside is that that adaptation also hampers their ability to nab their food and get busy with mates. But apparently, they consider the trade-off worthwhile. And when you think about it, that really speaks volume. Here's Oustra with The Noise. With The Noise.
We're going to take a quick break now, but we will be right back with a union rep who tells us how the toxic drug supply in Saskatoon has led to a temporary closure of two local libraries.
And standing up for the utterly spineless, we'll hear from a nature writer who's taking a stand for invertebrates and asking animal lovers around the world to back their favorite backboneless animal in a global contest.
Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
It is 6:35, and you're listening to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, DJ the DJ. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm-fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. Itasca Waters continues their Practical Water Wisdom webinar series Thursday, April 3rd at noon. This month, Dr. Emily Fairfax will explore the role of beavers in shaping ecosystems across the region. Register at itascawaters.org. Weather tonight, mostly clear skies, lows 14 to 20 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs 40 to 46. Northwest winds around 5 miles per hour, overnight lows in the mid-20s.
In Saskatoon, the overdose crisis isn't just overwhelming, it is exhausting. The Prairie City is struggling to deal with a spike in overdoses. Here's how Saskatoon firefighter Jaden Poirier described the situation to As It Happens earlier this month.
When I started as a firefighter about 15 years ago, we would maybe do one or two of these a year, you know, throughout the department I was with. And now we're doing between 15 and 20 of these overdoses every single day.
Mr. Poirier also talked about the burnout that a lot of first responders in the Saskatoon area are experiencing because of the tainted drug supply, which is leaving organizations overwhelmed and understaffed. Last week, the only supervised consumption site in Saskatoon temporarily shut its doors because of staff exhaustion. And the crisis isn't just affecting frontline workers. The Saskatoon Public Library has also temporarily closed two locations because of safety concerns. Kara Stelmischuk is a staff representative of the Canadian Union of Public Employees, which represents library workers. We reached her in Saskatoon.
Kara, has Saskatoon had to do something like this before, to close libraries?
I know that previously the libraries have adjusted hours to, you know, to reflect what's been going on in their neighborhoods. So not extending their hours past a certain time in the evening, that is definitely a measure that's been taken. Completely closing the library to the public, I believe, is brand new since COVID. So it's a noteworthy thing to have happen, that's for sure.
And a difficult decision, I would imagine, for the librarians, you know, and the people you represent.
Oh, absolutely. You know, library workers are really connected to communities. They have people that they meet almost every day, every week. They have people they support, that they help. Lots of community groups also use the libraries for their programming, and it's a safe place for people to go a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. So them being closed is really hard to get used to. But at the same time, they've seen an increase in some really, really troubling events. So this is a break to just readjust and have a bit of a breather before the doors open again.
What was the moment that they came to this decision? I mean, to go from, okay, we won't extend our hours past a certain point, to now shutting down temporarily. That's a big step. So what happened that made them believe that a temporary shutdown was the right move?
Recently, there has been an increase in overdoses. So there is a supply of drugs that have come onto the streets of Saskatoon they're calling it a poison supply. So it's definitely concerning. And all of a sudden, I remember I was in one meeting with the executive members of my local QP 2669, and they were just discussing how this last week they had had four incidences where they had people that weren't sleeping and that they couldn't wake up. So something has hit the streets that's making it that much more dangerous. And there are some pretty severe overdoses happening. There's also a safe consumption site that's downtown Saskatoon called Prairie Harm Reduction. Mm-hmm. And they've seen such an increase in overdoses and deaths that they've actually closed their doors just to give their staff time to process what they've been seeing, to seek a little bit of professional help, because it's upsetting. They are seeing some really, really dark times. And when those kinds of folks are also shutting it down just to take a breath from that's concerning. That's a really, really scary development.
But then what does that mean for people who access these spaces?
That means that they have to find another way to need what, you know, to find what they need. Like I said, when the professionals who want to do the work and want to do the help can't keep up, it's definitely a sign that something really, really bad is happening. The system somewhere is fractured.
And you mentioned, you know, the librarians. What kinds of specific details have they shared with you about how their jobs have changed in the midst of this crisis? Because it's not just, I would imagine, letting people in to use the restroom or to warm up. You know, what are they dealing with?
They are just seeing a pretty brazen array of behaviors. So they've got drug deals that are just happening right out on the main floor, not even outside the door. They're in the library in plain sight for people to see, in front of other patrons, in front of the library employees. It's just happening. And when, you know, consulted or challenged on it, these people get aggressive. They are verbally and physically intimidating towards the staff, towards the patrons, and it becomes a very unsafe situation for everybody. There's also the use of drugs happening within the library. Wherever people can find a quiet corner, it is happening. And if they can get into a bathroom, then usually the librarian finds out about it because a patron has come to them saying, we're waiting to use the washroom. Someone's been in there a long time. We don't know what's going on. And then it becomes a concern that somebody's hurt inside or unable to wake up.
How are other people who use the library reacting to, I mean, there's that reality that they also see, maybe not in the same frontline way that the library workers do, but now that to have these closures, how are they reacting?
I don't doubt that even before this, there were people who were just avoiding those particular branches. Mm-hmm. But if you live in that neighborhood and you don't have the means to drive to another library, you know, this is where you can access books and DVDs and all those niceties of life that no one's actually expecting to pay for.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So it's gonna affect them to have those places closed. But at the same time, I'm sure anybody there on a regular basis has seen something that they, you know, never thought they would see at a library. Like I said, that there are patrons who have seen this behavior and have had these people act aggressively towards them as well. But then you have a library worker trying to get in front of that situation and make sure that the patrons are safe. And it's not a great situation for people who are working in a library. Like, they just want to make sure people can find the materials they want and that they have help when they need it and that they have a nice, safe place to go. And it's a certain element that is seeing that as a vulnerability, and they're exploiting it.
The two libraries are set to reopen for regular service at this point on April 21st. So people who live there can look forward to that. But what would you like to see happen or change so that the libraries don't have to close again temporarily? There are different ideas about how to deal with this crisis and help people who need help, but also let people access the services that they need to access. So what would you like to see personally?
So we're seeing a shortage of, you know, temporary spaces and shelters for the unhoused. We're seeing that there's not enough supports for addiction services. We're not seeing enough supports for people who are in a mental health crisis. That all ends up out on the street, and there's nowhere else for it to go. And that's just the truth of the matter. There is nowhere else for these people to go. So they do find themselves a lot of the time walking through an open door into a warm building, or at least they can use the bathroom. Because that's just a humanity thing. There's no easy answers, I guess.
I think that's the one thing everyone agrees on as they try to,
absolutely,
to try to help. Kara, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
No, thank you so much.
Kara Stelmaschuk is a staff rep for the Canadian Union of Public Employees. We reached her in Saskatoon. It's an award that recognizes people who are making tourism more inclusive and accessible. And earlier this month, the Tourism Industry Association of British Columbia announced that Real North Adventures had won it. It's a fishing charter business based in Prince George. Jerry Doust is the owner and head guide. In an interview with the CBC this morning, he talked about doing a review of his business and seeing a gap in the service he was providing to people who use wheelchairs or have mobility issues. So he got to work on a new boat.
First thing was to kind of go over what are all the things, the accessible features that the boat needs. And then the first thing we did was look at, okay, is there anything out there? And so scoured the internet, but there was nothing out there in BC and Canada you could just buy that already had these features built in or that were easy to add. So then we had to look at fabricating something from scratch. So we worked with a few companies, got some preliminary designs back, and it was good. We were looking at more of a hydraulic front-loading boat that, you know, would drop down on a platform and you could just go in. But then we kind of went away from that because we didn't want to beef up the accessibility features so much to the point where we diluted the fishing experience. So that's what led us to one of the hunting utility craft designs from Crestliner that kind of just was built for hunters, but it has all of the accessible features that are not, shouldn't say all, but a lot of them already built into the boat. So we ended up just buying that boat as the base hull and then getting CC Industries in Prince George, which was amazing to work with, a fabrication company that came up with a custom rail system and ramp system that we added to the boat and modified it. And now we've got a boat that not only has all the accessible features to do a front load and a side load for someone who uses a wheelchair, but it also has a casting deck, and it allows anyone that's on board to not just fish, but do all the methods and techniques. So you can get up on the casting deck, fly fish, throw crankbaits, bait cast, spin fishing. All the different methods and techniques are very easy for someone to do on the boat.
Oh, it sounds fantastic. Has anybody who uses a wheelchair, have they had the chance to go fishing yet?
Yeah, we did about 3 trips last year. We decided to, you know, let's see what the upper limits of the boat's capabilities are, and we were able to comfortably have 2 people who use wheelchairs in the boat at the same time with 3 additional guests and myself as the captain. So it's a very roomy boat that's rated up to 7 individuals.
What did they say?
Oh, they loved it. It was a pretty emotional day, I'll be honest, especially for me. Like, it just, you know, seeing someone just have the opportunity to kind of go fishing and just be able to do it in a way that I think wasn't like previously available, that type of experience. And so it was a pretty emotional day, but yeah, they had really great things to say, and hopefully this sparks other businesses and other guides in the industry to, you know, look at their services and see what they can do about them. If anyone's out there, you know, listening, you know, the conceptual plans that we came up with, like, there's nothing proprietary about them. I'd be more than happy if they email us. I can email them the PDF of the plans, and they can use them and adapt them as they need to.
That was Jerry Doust, the owner of Real North Adventures, talking to Shelley Joyce, the host of Daybreak Kamloops. The eyes of the nation are on Ottawa this week as a federal election gets underway, but another much-anticipated contest is unfolding too, and many eyes will be on its winner, which may itself have many eyes. For the second year in a row, The Guardian is running an Invertebrate of the Year competition, and this time, it's global. Last year's winner was none other than the noble earthworm, and so far this year's victor seems liable to be a bit more colorful, albeit no less overlooked. Patrick Barkham is a natural history writer and the architect of the Guardian's contest. We reached him in Norfolk, England.
Patrick, the word spineless is certainly not a term of endearment, particularly if you're lobbing it in an argument, as some may have. But for invertebrates, it's another story. What does that word evoke for you?
Yeah, it's such a shame, isn't it, that it's become this big insult in human society, because actually us spined creatures are by far the tiny minority on Earth. There's less than 5% of all life forms on Earth are creatures like us. The vast majority are invertebrates, and they're the spiders and snails and insects and beetles and crustaceans and corals and many more obscure and tiny creatures that, of course, are the basis for all other life on Earth.
So you unveiled this year's competition a few weeks ago. You've been accepting submissions, and you've put together a short list that's going to be unveiled this week and next. Tell us about today's offering.
Today's the first on the shortlist is fairly gruesome. It's the tongue-biting louse. And this is an incredible little crustacean that finds a fish, it burrows in through the gills, and then bites away the fish's tongue and clings to what's left of the stump. And it then takes on the role of tongue for the fish, basically, and eats a load of what the fish eats, but shares enough to enable the fish to carry on living.
Oh, okay.
And the fish can stay alive for years in this way. I mean, it's the stuff of horror films, and actually did inspire a horror film. So it's gruesome but ingenious.
That horror film was The Bay, for anyone. Our producer Chloe pulled that up for anyone who wants to take a closer look at the tongue-biting louse and the horror movie that it inspired. And is that why it made it to the top 10, the ingenious part?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's amazing the niches that all these little invertebrates find, different ways of making a living on Earth. The second, actually, on our shortlist is found all over Canada, and that's Bombylius major, the dark-edged bee fly.
Oh, that sounds sinister also.
Yes, well, this one absolutely is a sinister one, Neil. You're dead right. It hums like a bee, pollinates flowers like a bee, and is cute and fluffy like a bee. Mm. But it's a fly, and it lays its eggs around where solitary bees nest, and its larvae eat the solitary bee babies, basically. So it's another devious, cunning creature. But wonderful, you know, beautiful, attractive, dynamic looking insect. And it also, the females twerk. They do this amazing twerking maneuver to gather up sand, which they then coat their eggs with to better camouflage their eggs.
Were most of the people, Patrick, scientists who wrote to you, or are there gardeners and others who reached out as well?
It was a real mix, yeah. And we had very, people who know next to nothing about insects but wanted just to nominate the cicada they hear from their porch. There were plenty of sort of funny nominations. Some scientists nominated the species that they had themselves discovered, but equally there were lots of ordinary people too nominating things that just enrich their lives or make them feel happy.
And is there one creature that didn't make the list that you think deserves an honorable mention in this conversation?
Oh, golly, there were so many. But what one interesting theme actually this year was that lots of people nominated very resilient small animals. And I feel like in times of global turmoil, we're sort of drawing comfort from seeing resilience in other small, apparently powerless creatures, because so many of us feel powerless at this moment in time. And there was a brilliant nomination for a creature called the scaly-footed snail, which lives in volcanic vents and makes its shell out of iron and even protects its, you know, snails have this lovely soft foot, this soft inside, and even protects that with iron plates. And one of our readers said, you're not going to get a more hardcore nomination.
Is there one that came up over and over again?
There were a surprising number of backers for the tardigrades. And the tardigrades are these multi-segmented micro animals. And they've been nicknamed water bears and moss pigs because if you look at them under a microscope, they look incredibly cute and they live on damp moss. They mostly live in water. And tardigrades as a group of species have survived five great extinction events and individual tardigrades. So one does make the shortlist, Milnesium tardigradum. And that survived being put in outer space. Interestingly, one of our Canadian readers nominated a species that has made our shortlist. And she's a scientist and a sci-fi writer herself. Oh. And she nominated the common rotifer, which is another microscopic animal. And it's all female. And it's got along very well without men for millions of years. So
there will be fans of that for sure. The earthworm was the winner last year. I mean, that's pretty simple. I mean, they deserve credit, perhaps, but what's your sense of how this year is going to go?
Well, I was surprised at the outpouring of love for the common earthworm last year. But I do think readers seem to be, or people in general, seem very drawn towards insects that are useful and sort of maybe unsung heroes, you know, and perform all these important tasks. I suspect the really gruesome ones, the tongue-biting louse and so forth, won't triumph in the end. I think it will be a more useful creature. But I do quite fancy the tardigrades this year, I think.
Not that you want to tip the scales, Patrick. I mean,
we have to stay neutral. I'm very neutral. And honestly, I will be delighted if any of these creatures win. They are very worthy animals, all of them.
I'm glad we could speak, Patrick. Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Patrick Barkham is a natural history writer with The Guardian. We reached him in Norfolk, England. It was a dream come true, until it wasn't. 77-year-old Winnipegger Pat Fletcher found a car that he'd been after for years, a pristine 1968 Dodge Charger RT. It was in Texas, but bringing that muscle car home turned out to be more challenging than he'd expected, thanks to recent changes that he discovered when he arrived at the border.
We pulled over to the side and we came inside. We sat down and they were taking about a half an hour and they're all talking to you, looking through all these books and manuals, and it's like they didn't know what was going on. And then they finally come up to me and showed me a piece of paper with $46,636.49.
Which, by the way, is 50% of what you paid for the car. I just want to point that out as people are following percentages. Okay. And what was your reaction to that?
You know, I don't know how to describe it. I thought it was a joke. Actually, my daughter and I thought they were kidding. You know, and then when we realized their service is serious, I started to get nauseous and shake, and I went and threw up in the bathroom. My daughter took over talking to them. So I couldn't even talk to them, you know.
Oh, Pat.
It was terrible.
I'm so sorry. So you have this huge financial shock. You're sitting there.
Yeah.
How did they explain what this amount of money owed was about?
It was all the tariffs, see? All the border guards, Canada and U.S. were so good. They were on my side completely. Wanted me to get that car home. I had to get to my pills because it was supposed to be just like an hour long drive each way, you know, pick up your car and, you know, and it just turned out to be a nightmare. And they said, you know, he did say, you don't have to do this, but I would advise you to take your car back to the American side, you know, and
store it or park it or, figure this out. So we heard on the news that after all of this turmoil, to say the least, for you and your family, obviously then you're in the States a little longer. Your car is still in the States. It's in North Dakota. Is that right?
Yeah. Right now I'm just waiting for the stupid tariffs to drop. I said, well, I know Trump's an idiot and all that. The classic cars. They don't charge them anything, any kind of charge, you know, cheaper insurance.
So you're waiting for the tariffs, so hopefully.
Yeah, I'm kind of waiting for them to come down.
This is not something you can get a refund on, by the way.
No.
Right? It's not like you're going back. So what is your message to other people who are listening to your story this morning, Pat?
That's why I wanted this on here. You know, I've been on TV too, and I say, well, get it, you know, be careful. You know, this could happen to you. And since that, I've had about 12 people call me all over Canada in the same position. And so I just want everybody to don't have what happened to me. It's a nightmare.
Pat Fletcher talking to Marcy Marcuse today on Information Radio in Winnipeg.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.